KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I had it right there talking about how thick a coat of awesome sauce Petraeus is bathed in. The thing never crossed my mind.
Well, we are going to make the math add up, and obviously we're going to succeed on that. We're going to have a balanced budget. I know we're going to succeed on that.
What the president's campaign did was focus on certain members of his base coalition, give them extraordinary financial gifts from the government, and then work very aggressively to turn them out to vote.
That was Mittens Romney talking about the gifts Obama gave his constituents that got him elected. You also heard John Stewart going on about Paula Broadwell. And Jay Inslee talking about how he's going to make the math add up to balance the state budget. Some of the stories that have been swirling about this week. And since it's Friday, we thought we would be joined by our panel of experts.
Whoa.
You people are experts now.
Oh, experts.
Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Knut Berger writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com. Essex Porter is, I wanted to give you the whole senior reporter at Cairo.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And Eric C. Barnett, senior reporter at Publicola.
You're giving out like canes this morning.
You're like Obama. You know that?
I am
giving the gifts.
I'm just giving the gifts. So I hope you all will turn out at the polls to elect me. But let's start local. Let's start sort of local. We'll start in Olympia. Jay Inslee named a transition team. A beginning of the transition team. Educators, what does that tell you?
Well, he did run on that whole, we've got to beef up education by enhancing our economy. And so some of the interesting folks on the transition team, one of them was Brad Smith from Microsoft, who actually, is an expert in transportation as well as education. And it should be duly noted that he maxed out his contributions to McKenna, but then gave some amount to...
That was interesting.
That was interesting. So that is a little bit of reaching across to the others who maybe weren't pulling for you. You know, we don't have many other details of, people that that Jay Inslee will be appointing to some of the key positions. He's been a little bit more quiet about that.
He hopes these people will help him guide him.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe he's going for that whole band of conflicting ideas for his cabinet.
It didn't sound like that. He was doing interviews with reporters this week. I got to sit down with him yesterday. It didn't sound so much like he was going for conflicting ideas, but he was really focused on getting great talent. And made the point repeatedly that it didn't matter whether it was Democrat, Republican, or Independent, but he wanted people from private industry who had a record of accomplishment or had a strong vision. And one of the things he talked about doing was giving people the opportunity to do a lot more telecommuting. You know, if a talented person, you know, for whatever family reasons or reasons could not move to Olympia or couldn't commute to Olympia as much as someone might, he's willing to telecommute with them, whether it's from the Seattle area or from some other part of the state.
That's interesting. Do you think at this point he has a realistic assessment, Eric? I'll ask you.
Sure.
Of the budget.
In my personal opinion, no. I mean, I think that he understands we've got a $900 million hole in the budget. But what he has said is that he will not raise taxes. And, you know, I talked to State House Budget Chair Ross Hunter yesterday, and he's been saying this in other press as well, that that's completely unrealistic, because in addition to this $900 million, they've got, you know, estimated around $1.6 billion that they have to fill in education from the McCleary decision. So where is that money going to come from? I mean, I don't think Jay Inslee is saying except that we're going to grow the economy.
Grow the economy.
And I think that the economy grows way too slowly for that to be realistic.
He must know that, Knut. He must know he's facing a big hole.
Well, the Ross Hunter estimate was a $3 billion hole for the next biennium if you add in the education spending and the roughly $1.9 billion to $1 billion hole. And that's even with some economic recovery factored in. It was really interesting. I mean, the voters, you know, Inslee ran as a Democrat who was said basically, I'm not going to raise taxes. That was in sync with the voters who basically elected Democrats, you know, to the statewide offices, but then said, we don't want you to spend any money. Or we want to make it really, really hard for you to raise revenues. I don't think Inslee's ever been realistic about it. I mean, I agree with Erica on that. I don't think he's realistic about it. I think they're going to have to get more revenues from somewhere. I don't see where you could come up with, you know, $3 billion in cuts to compensate for the additional spending that you'll have.
One thing that came out of our talk yesterday was that you know, during the campaign, Inslee, under questioning by reporters, said that he would veto tax increases.
Really?
I asked him yesterday if that was still his stand. And he was very careful not to reiterate that as his stand. He backed away from the veto threat. Now, to be clear, he did not back away from his position that there should be no tax increases, but he explained backing away from the veto threat by saying, look, he's talking with legislators now, and he doesn't want to start his relationship with them with a threat.
Well, what was so interesting to me about Inslee's position through the whole campaign, you know, vis-a-vis McKenna, is McKenna kind of backed him into this corner, or I guess he saw it that way, where he had to be the anti-tax guy. And you know, and so he said that he opposed this levy swap, which would raise taxes on some of the state and lower taxes on the other part of the state. Conveniently, it would raise taxes on King County, and it would lower taxes on the part of the state that voted against Jay Inslee and for Rob McKenna. And so now I think he's kind of stuck. And, you know, the only plan that's out there right now is the levy swap.
Well, interestingly, you know, the theme of the campaign, and we've said this here before, but the theme of the campaign was they were both going to spend, both candidates were going to spend $1 billion more on education. They were going to do it without raising taxes. But then they spent the rest of the campaign saying, even though I said I'm not going to raise taxes, that other guy over there, he is so going to raise taxes. And I was talking to Dwight Pelz earlier this week, and he was talking about the fact that they did their research, and they found that one thing where Rob McKenna had said that he might be open to the tax swap, and then just that became the theme of the ads. So as we're talking about this, and as Inslee's trying to sort of, maybe as you're saying, back away from the threat of a veto, there's a place for this to occur, but it doesn't, you know, it's a little wiggle room. They'd have to go after the loopholes.
Right, and he talked about that.
But that's, loopholes that's where never add up enough. There's always a constituency and a lobbyist and an inability to go after the loopholes. So when they seem like a nice pile of money, they end up not being the pile of money.
Yeah. Part of the issue, too, is how you, using Joni's word, the wiggle, how you finesse the wiggle. The classic case of how not to do it is Mike Lowry, the last congressman elected governor of the state, who had to allay the business community concerns that he was going to raise taxes, who said, I will only raise taxes as a last resort. Between the election, after he was elected, and his inauguration, he said, I'm going to raise taxes. And even Democrats were furious with him because it was such a blatant spin. It was like, how did we get to the last resort?
We were in, yeah, the emergency had come.
The last resort,
the emergency
is the first
came
resort.
Like, what, two, a month after you got elected? I mean, it was, and it did a lot to damage Lowry's credibility.
Totally.
The other problem with Lowry, and this is one of the things that would be really interesting to watch Inslee, is, you know, he was an outsider to Olympia, essentially, and he had real trouble with some of his appointments and getting a handle on the bureaucracy down there. Not in terms of reform, but just making good appointments. And that's one of the things I think it'll be really interesting to see how Inslee does, because outsiders are not always the most effective people to appoint to run a bureaucracy that knows it's going to be there longer than you. You know, if you go in to run a department, and that's even a problem for department heads, you know, that you appoint, they have to have credibility with the people who work for them. And you can't, if you think you can run Olympia or government like a business, you're wrong. It's not.
And also this week, the Seattle Times broke the story about the fact that the state Senate may not, y'all thought it was Democratic controlled. Well, it depends on what happens down, it partly depends on what happens down in that really close
in
race.
The 17th.
In Vancouver.
Don Benton and...
Rodney Tom, who's a Democrat but used to be a Republican but might become sort of a team player with the Republicans again, along with Tim Sheldon, might change the balance of power. So Inslee might not even have a Democratic-controlled Senate.
You guys talked to Popocatépetl, had a little... some questions for Rodney Tom.
And I actually have not read that post yet, unfortunately, but I do, you know, I do think that's right.
It makes
and
him
I think,
the most powerful man in Olympia. That's how the
well,
the
Tim Sheldon and Rodney Tom, yeah. Certainly, because, you know, it's true. I mean, I don't think that, Knut, you wrote a piece about, you know, us being a completely one-party state, but I think we're not in the state Senate. In the state Senate, we're going to be a Republican state. Now, that 17th district still has to go through a recount. I think last time I looked, they were 101 votes apart.
105.
So
obscure details.
So you know, so it could swing the other way. It could go for Democrat Tim Probst, but right now the trend is not looking good for him.
Well, Jay Inslee yesterday, I guess, said that he foresaw keeping a lot of people in power in place from Gregoire's administration. He didn't name names. But he was alluding to the fact, I think, following up on what you were saying, Knut, that there are people already there that maybe will help him do that job. But so what does so we have this legislature that looks divided. What about overall? I mean, where's Frank Chop in this, Essex? Where what does the legislature say to this? They do have, as you said, Tim Eymond's initiative passing overwhelmingly and the rejection of those advisory votes and those two tax increases.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, based on what I've covered in the legislature over the years, I would never underestimate the ability of both Frank Chop and Ed Murray, the leader of the Democratic caucus, and maybe the majority leader, depending on how things turn out, to really negotiate through the narrow shoals. Ed Murray managed to negotiate from nothing. Now same-sex marriage is legal. He took years. He has patience. Frank Chop also has patience and a lot of negotiating skill. So it will seem maybe messier and more confusing than it has been when you know you have solid Democratic majorities and a Democratic governor. But, you know, they still may be able to get a lot done.
It'll be interesting to see how much, you know, the mayoral race in Seattle affects that. If people believe or if Ed Murray declares that he's going to run, you know, does that impact how much power he actually has? I don't know that it will, because I think he is a very skilled negotiator. But that's, you know, potentially going to be a factor.
And yet they have that big looming question of education in all this, right, and funding education. So what effect does the win for charter schools have, do you think, on the discussion?
Well, I don't think it has a big impact other than to say that the voters, by the narrow margin, are interested in some innovation. It doesn't have a big money impact, as I understand it, because you're creating over 5 years 40 schools. You know, how much does that cost? And that comes from districts and things like that. But it does send a message that the voters are interested in something different in K-12.
I think it sends a message that the voters are desperate. And they, because education is so underfunded in the state, and they, I mean, I don't think it sends that clear of a message about innovation so much as we want something because the current system just isn't working.
But interestingly, the that passage of that is very, very narrow. I think it's really just under 51%, just over 50%, despite a huge campaign in favor. So, you know, it seems like voters are, they may be desperate. But they're clearly divided on whether charter schools are the answer.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it tiptoed to victory, and you know, I think it is a way that people can both. It offers an opportunity both for people in some areas to tiptoe into experimental or, you know, alternative education, and particularly education that targets groups that are maybe underserved by the public school, because the nonprofits that run the charter schools can attract resources, charitable donations and whatnot, resources that, you know, a lot of low-income neighborhoods can't get from the parents. So I think the reason it passed is you know, is because it got pretty watered down. I mean, you know, it was described as this kind of, you know, by the teachers, you know, it's sort of like this is going to ruin everything. It's going to drain the public schools, et cetera, et cetera. I think 40 schools, I think with the kind of supervision and limitations there are, it's really just a tiptoe.
Well, what do you think, just before the break, what do you think that we learned from the polls in terms of how voters think the state should respond to the idea of amply funding education? I mean, they have this court order. They have billion-plus dollars they have to find. But I mean,
my takeaway that doesn't directly answer that, although that's part of it because it's part of the answer to charter schools. We're like the rest of the country in this one way. We're very divided. Look how close our governor's race was. Look how close our Secretary of State's race was. Look how close the charter school vote was. We don't agree on a lot of stuff here. We're almost, 50.5 to 49.5 on a lot of topics. And so we do have to wrestle exactly with the narrowness of some of these decisions.
But one thing we did agree on was that we didn't like taxes, which, sends a mixed message.
And that we like pot.
And that we like pot, and we hope pot will help us raise money to...
And the most interesting county-by-county map from the election was the county-by-county map on legalizing marijuana because, normally it's Puget Sound against the rest of the state. You can watch these maps go by. But that one reached all the way across the northern Washington counties into, I imagine, pot-growing country.
And even where it was in those counties that rejected it, it was much tighter than the other
right.
than the other votes, like same-sex marriage and the like.
So when do we get the $500 million? Because apparently we could really use it.
Yeah, and it's going to, and if at all, when
maybe
you ask James, it's going to
really
be a while.
That's interesting because maybe when you do a budget, you push that off to the second year when the pot stores will be open.
Pot stores.
I don't know what you call it.
Beat one little drum on the education thing just quickly too. Is to me, I think it's interesting that we're talking about spending more money on education as in putting money in schools, but at the same time the budget has required draconian cuts to things like the state library, the state museums, historical societies, the state archives. Is that not education? In other words, how it's defined,
only
I think.
Students in chairs studying tests.
Exactly, which is just
studying for tests.
Dumb.
Yeah, studying for tests.
And poverty programs,
nutrition programs and poverty programs. I mean, there's a way in which we've got some of these definitions, I think, too siloed. And we're trying to compensate for something on the one hand while slashing these state programs on the other. I mean, we have, when this biennium is up and looking at the next biennium, we have things like a state park system that we've taken out of the general fund and
they were counting on that pass to fund it. And
right.
It's not exactly selling like hotcakes.
The pass thing was not well thought out. The reason it wasn't well thought out is because somebody said, we're going to take this out of the general fund. How much money do they need to make up? Let's put that on the line item. And they didn't really have a well thought out plan or system for making that transition.
Well, maybe there's a shift in philosophy because for a long time the complaint was, why are you putting things that are necessities on the ballot and not letting us vote on things that we want to have choices over? Maybe people are just going to start thinking.
That's as old as the hills. King County's been making their budget a la carte for 10 years now. They take all the popular stuff and put it on the ballot, the parks, the library.
Maybe we're getting used to it. That's what
Speak
I'm wondering.
For yourself.
Let me take a break with Essex Porter, with Eric C. Barnett, Joni Balter, Knut Berger. We'll come back and talk about, let's talk about the Republican Party for just a little bit. This is Weekday.
What happens when you take this familiar piece of music and stretch it to last 24 hours?
It's surreal. It's like being trapped in the climax of the most incredible epic film for hours.
Jad here. This week on Radiolab, we take a closer look at time.
And that comes your way tonight at 7 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 10:25.
Support for KUOW comes from Emirates, featuring multi-course meals, including wines, in every class. Non-stop flights to Dubai depart from Seattle daily. More at emirates.com/USA. Fly Emirates. Hello tomorrow.
Cloudy skies and 47 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 50 today. Forecast calls for clouds all day with a chance of showers. Same for tonight, cloudy skies, chance of showers, the low in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy, rainy, and breezy tomorrow, the high in the low 50s.
We are reviewing the news of the week with Eric C. Barnett of Publicola / Seattle Met, Essex Porter of Cairo 7, Joni Balter, Seattle Times, Knut Berger, author of Pugetopolis, and at Seattle Magazine and at Crosscut. There's been a lot of hand-wringing and finger-pointing and blame going around about why Mitt Romney lost. I loved that Haley Barbour said the Republicans, I'm just quoting, should get a proctology exam after the election. What? What? In this state, which put up pretty moderate candidates, middle-of-the-road candidates, what should this state's Republican Party be thinking about?
Well, it sounds like they are thinking about what to do next, what's their bench, you know, what they got one candidate elected statewide, Secretary of State, Kim Wyman, and that is now what? Is that the 50 years of Republican
right.
Secretaries of State?
Yeah, something like
and
that.
And 12 years of Thurston County Auditors as Secretaries of State. Just to go for the ultra obscure here. But, you know, they are obviously going to try to figure out. I remember Kirby Wilbur, who's very quotable on election night, saying if Rob McKenna can't, he said this before the vote was counted, by the way, if Rob McKenna can't get elected in Washington, I forget who, he's moving to Texas or somebody's moving to Texas. But clearly, you know,
it wouldn't be Rob McKenna because he would be too liberal for Texas.
Yeah. So clearly they have to, you know, regroup, figure out who they're rising stars will be and who can talk to the, you know, the electorate in a winning way. You have to look at this election and wonder, if you're Rob McKenna, what would have happened differently if he hadn't, you know, joined that healthcare lawsuit, which could have been a big factor. What would have happened if they didn't put a referendum on gay marriage and if pot wasn't on the ballot? What if?
Yeah, I think gay marriage and pot were big factors, but I think the National Republican Party just killed, you know, Republicans in states everywhere, even moderate Republicans. I mean, Rob McKenna is not a Tea Party guy, but he was getting tagged a Tea Party Republican, and that was very powerful, especially in those last couple weeks of the national campaign, you know, when rape became, you know, a debatable issue.
The Rape Caucus,
who yes. All lost.
All lost. Rob McKenna had, unfortunately, they had video of him in front of a Tea Party meeting. That didn't help him, I'm sure, if that was one of the factors. Where do the Republicans go?
Well, it's interesting because in the Kirby Wilbur comment, because Rob McKenna has been carefully over the years, very involved with a group cultivating what they called mainstream Republicans, you know, to reacting to the sort of far-right grassroots core of the state party, which has been in place, what, since Pat Robertson won the primary here in, when was that?
1988.
Wow. So that's been a big factor. And he's been cultivating people who, like him, are much more sort of realistic about government. They're not anti-government, even though they're conservative. And being a kind of Reagan conservative like Rob McKenna is, is now a little bit on the left of the Republican Party nationally. So they have that, you know, Eric is right, you know, they have that brand problem. And the thing is that it's like the hope was, and I talked to Republicans on the East Side about McKenna. I think there was hope that if he was able to get elected, he would be able to sort of, from Olympia, rebuild the Republican bench. He would be able to get people into office, into running departments and whatnot, and would have a base from which to build. And it's kind of the closest thing you could say. It's McKenna is carrying on a bit of the legacy of the Slade-Gorton branch of the state party, which, you know, a lot of business people are in. You know, Slade was successful for a time anyway, running statewide. The problem is that there's very few of those people, and the centrists who seem to be able to make a better case for themselves in the suburbs tend to be Democrats.
Well, what impact – we were talking about the three senators who are Democrats who could – or two or three, I guess we're vague on that – who could make have an impact on Republican power in the legislature, in the Senate. Are there leaders in the Republican Party in the legislature who are those moderate – other members, I should say – who are those moderate centrist Republicans who can start to build?
Well, yes, but do you know? So they start to fill the bench. You think of somebody like a Steve Litzow in the Senate. You know, he ran for his life in this race, for a lot of reasons. But he was the first Republican to come out and say he would support gay marriage. Well, that's a distinction that did separate him from some others down there. But is he well known enough? He's only run on basically the 41st district, Mercer Island, and some neighborhoods there. So they have to develop these folks.
An education reformer, too, right?
Yes, and a charter school proponent and an education reformer as well.
Right. I'm just seeing a news release about Richard DeBolt being reelected as the House Republican leader. And, I've never talked to him about ambitions for perhaps higher office, but I wonder if he might be a person who again, could represent Republicans more broadly in the state.
Well, he'd have to make a little change, wouldn't he? From his hasn't he been further to the right in the years past, or has he been more of a centrist? I'm trying to remember DeBolt when he was in leadership before.
He's had the job for quite some time.
Right?
But I don't.
Well, all right. So that's at the legislative level. What about the fact that Kathy McMorris Rogers, she's the House Republican Conference Chair now. That's a big leadership issue. Does that help?
She has potential in the state because she's such a high national profile. She's in the top four of the House leadership. She fought for that this week and won it. She had an interesting comment, if you saw it, though. She said the new GOP has to be more modern.
Not more moderate.
What does more modern mean?
Don't say what you think.
Ouch.
I think it means, you know, she elaborated on that a little bit, you know, and I think what she meant was, you know, not so troglodyte, although Kathy McMorris Rogers is extremely conservative. She, you know, she has all of the same extreme positions as her Tea Party colleagues. But also she talked about, you know, wanting to get more on social media. And I think that's kind of code for wanting to get young people to consider voting for the Republican Party.
And more diverse messengers is what she was also speaking of.
But the problem is, I mean, she's the highest ranking Republican in Congress or the House?
The House.
So, you know, she's kind of like the kindler, gentler face of the, you know, extreme right wing of the Republican Party. And I think Tom Price, her opponent, was seen as, you know, the less kind, less gentle face. And, you know, I think that is a big reason she was elected, in addition to the fact that she campaigned like crazy
for it. And Paul Ryan was behind Price.
Right. Oh, and she did explicitly campaign on the fact that, you know, hey, guys, shouldn't a woman also be in leadership since our party has such problems attracting women voters?
But it's not a demographic problem. It's, you know, it's an issues problem. And they seem to think that it's a demographic. We have the wrong demographics. And, you know, and we just, you know, and the demographics of the voter base are not right for our party. But it's that their issues are, you know, are ones that people consider wrong.
And she may do well in Congress, you know, at the national level, as long as the Republicans are in control and whatnot. But in terms of whether she could turn that into, say, a statewide leadership position or something, you know, within Washington State, the Eastern Washington is not going to be the base of anybody who can run statewide. Many votes are on this side of the mountain, and those votes on those key cultural issues are not going to align. I just right before the election, I was over in Spokane and driving through and listening to endless things like Doc Hastings ads on the radio.
He was spending money on ads?
Yeah, he was.
I love it when they spend
and they were
the money
terrible.
Really,
I mean, they were ads that, you know, where he was preaching to the choir. It was all you know, about Obama hating small business and taking that selective, they didn't build that quote and stuff like that. I mean, there that base over there is very conservative and makes it very difficult for anybody. So if they are going to find somebody who's got that sort of statewide potential who could make a Senate run or who could go statewide, they're going to have to look for somebody who can get votes on this side. And that's the McKenna message that's so dreary for them.
What is McKenna's role now? I mean, what usually happens? They go to a law firm when they lose.
They go to a law firm and they become this sort of he's too young to be the elder statesman, but he can be a statesman for the party and sort of what it needs.
But I imagine
he wants to bring people together and figure out what next for them, right?
Yeah, I have not had a chance to talk with him, but I see him as a prime candidate for the Harvard's Kennedy School of Government in some
way. Oh, sure. That's actually the first step, isn't it? And then you come back.
But that's only for a month.
Well, you know, I remember former Mayor Royer was there for much more than a month. So.
But he was leading the Institute for Politics.
Yeah. Nobody grows a beard like Nichols did for a while.
said Skip.
Would be good. So I got that email too, by the way. So Richard DeBolt, Joel Kretz, Dan Christensen, J.T. Wilcox, Matt Shea, Liz Pike, Paul Harris. They're all the leaders in the State House. Any names there that you guys know or that sound like they would be people who would be reaching across to the other side? Yeah, well, we'll have to talk to them. We'll find out. So the other thing that was discussed this week was, well, maybe the long lines what you're saying, Erica, maybe the Republicans will – the culture wars are over and the Republicans just will move on. What do you think?
Well, considering that they're talking about seceding and, you know, 100,000 people in Texas signed a petition saying they want to secede. And considering that, you know, that all the response so far has been kind of to go into lockdown mode and say, you know, and say again that, it's a demographic problem. It's not our message. It's not our message. I don't think they're going to change right away or, I mean, if ever.
I do think there shall be candidate school where they say, if you wish to be a candidate for the Republican Party, you never bring up the words abortion and rape in the same sentence anywhere ever.
Well, the problem is that question is going to keep getting asked, and they're going to have to. I mean, that's what happened with Koster. He was caught on tape because a reporter asked him, you know, do you support abortion in cases of rape? And he had to answer the question because it's a real question.
So I hear you saying no. The culture wars will continue. They just won't debate same-sex marriage in our state for very long. What does that change mean? How do you see that? December 6th, Dow Constein said he's going to be out there December 6th
at
12:01.
He's opening the licensing office.
Signing the licenses.
And City Hall shall be open, Eli wrote, on the 9th. I think it's a three-day waiting period for weddings, for marriages.
Well, all right. So,
you know, it will be interesting to see how many weddings there actually are because now, you know, straight people don't all get married when they become couples. Straight people struggle with that, you know. So now we'll see. Yes, there'll be an initial spate of marriages, but I just wonder, if once things settle down and everyone who knows they want to get married now gets married, whether we will see, you know, some great surge.
Well, there'll be the marriage rush, and then there'll be the divorce rush a couple of years later.
Well, and you know, there's a sort of you know, little known fact that all the domestic partners now are going to either have to dissolve those partnerships. Or they're going to become married. And, you know, I don't know if that's necessary. I mean, there are couples who live together, you know, who consider each other partners, straight couples, that wouldn't necessarily want to be sort of forced into marriage by a law. So, I hope everybody's aware of that.
Yeah, the law changed in that sense.
You know, it's an enormous breakthrough. And I think, you know, I don't see it. You know, I have a hard time imagining after this point it being overturned. I mean, I think the cultural wars will continue because there are churches and other groups that will continue to oppose it, that will continue to push values issues, all throughout the state that won't accept it. But I think, you know, over time.
Although it's interesting. I was reading that somewhere this morning that you know, when churches, you know, become like gay accommodating or whatever the term is, I mean, churches are dying. And when they invite gay people in, they, you know, they double in size. So, I mean, I think that's also a factor because, you know, the gay population, you know, says that, you know, they feel just as, you know, as religious and faithful and, you know, as a straight population.
I was reading a New Yorker article about the new senator, now new senator from Texas, who believes he can organize Hispanics along conservative lines across the country to counteract the organization that the Obama campaign and others have done. So we'll just have different kinds of culture wars, I imagine. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Let's talk about those big buildings at Lake Union, some other issues. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 10:40. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. More and more artists are turning to the internet to sell their art. What about you? If you make a living as an artist, where and how do you sell your art? Also, if you collect art, where do you buy it? KUOW's Ross Reynolds takes your phone calls at noon today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our feedback line, 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
Support for KUOW comes from the French American School of Puget Sound, committed to challenging students from age 3 to grade 8 to excel academically and thrive in French, American, and international cultures. Open houses will take place on November 13th and January 26th. More at FASPS.org.
Used to be in the tech world, anyway, that people look the other way when bosses behave badly. Yeah, not anymore.
Google actually has quite good data that insensitive bosses drive out the best talents.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How corporate nice actually hits the bottom line. That story and today's numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and much more coming up tonight at 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at tiaacref.org/WA.
We have cloudy skies and 47 degrees in Seattle. Expecting clouds the rest of today. Chance of showers, the high reaching 50. Cloudy tonight, chance of showers, the low in the mid-40s.
We're reviewing the news of the week with Joni Balter of the Seattle Times, Essex Porter of Cairo 7, Eric C. Barnett of Publicola, Seattle Met, Knut Berger of Crosscut.com. So Knut had mentioned how you can't run the last campaign because things changed. The Democrats had changed building on what they had already accomplished 4 years ago to increase their turnout. And you were saying
that is exactly what State Democratic Party Chair Dwight Pills told a class I teach at the UW.
What do you teach?
Opinion writing. What he said was you always have to have a different campaign every 4 years. You can't run the campaign you ran before. The campaign of 2008 had a lot to do with social media and younger voters. This one was more geeky than you could imagine. It was more scientific. In other words, and he called it modeling, that the Democratic Party seems to know from all their contact with voters, A, who voted. Everybody knows, both parties know that. But then they run this sort of modeling of who they think are their likely voters and contact them until they can't see straight, I guess, or vote, until they know that vote has been cast. So I gave the example. My daughter moved to California but failed to notify King County Elections. And so the weekend before the election, we had 6 people either physically at the door looking for her or, 4 others contacting us by phone. And at one point I thought, if she was here, they would physically remove her from this house along with her ballot to get that ballot turned in.
Campaigning by stalking.
And you were getting text messages.
I was getting text messages from Obama saying, call this person, call that person. This person hasn't voted. Phone bank. You can do it from your home. It's easy. I find it a little weird. I found it a little creepy. I'm not a natural phone banker by any means. And, the idea of calling up, my random neighbor and saying, I see you haven't turned your ballot in yet. So you're thinking about voting for Obama? It would just be
Can I have a cup of sugar and your ballot?
Yeah, it would it makes me a little uncomfortable.
These are the techniques that the business world actually uses to market products, and they're applied to politics. But the business world uses information that's publicly available to kind of figure out a profile of who you are and whether it would be worth it to chase you to sell the product, or in this case for the political parties, to chase you, put resources in to be sure your ballot gets mailed in.
And the next election will be all sabermetrics style campaigning, and Nate Silver, everybody's calling up Nate Silver and trying to figure out if they can hire him.
Nate Silver to decide who won.
Oops, sorry, Skip. Skip got the bad chair.
He got the trick chair.
Sorry.
Somebody's got to get it.
Somebody gets it each time. Yeah, Nate Silver will just decide who wins.
Well, you know, for all the anti-Nate Silver stuff, he nailed 50 states and the presidential election. That was pretty interesting. He's into modeling or some weird, some math thing that I don't understand.
What's interesting is that there are so many people at high levels, so many East Coast pundits who are willing to put aside the publicly available information about polls that Nate Silver uses to simply say, you know, the probabilities are this is what's going to happen in a particular state. And, you know, the pundits leave D.C. for a day. They go to Ohio. They see a lot of cheers for Romney or somebody. And they say, you know, here on the ground, the feeling I'm picking up is, yes. You know, the Obama campaign never did a national poll. They only did state polls.
Is that right?
They knew what was going on in Ohio and Florida and North Carolina and Nevada every second of the day.
Well, and what's interesting about what Nate Silver does is he looks at what's happened in the past, and nobody else has ever done that. And he just runs, you know, here are the last, you know, however many elections. Here's what happened. Here's how this county voted. Here's how this county voted. And it works.
Somebody said, Gallup, Rasmussen, you guys need to fix your formulas.
Well, I think it might have been Nate Silver who did a post-election analysis of he ran this chart of how the what the polls said in the final weekend and what actually happened, and it was sort of neener, I thought.
Yeah, and Rasmussen did a lot better than Gallup.
Yeah. Sort of along the lines of what Taj Mahal said, isn't it, Skip? Everybody I knew had to take a giant step, so it must have sold well.
That's right.
All right, let's look at the city a little bit. And let's start with the city planners presented the Vulcan-backed South Lake Union Compromise, as they called it, of the three big towers down there on what will be the reconstituted Valley Street. Knut, you look at those things. How do those look from you, the models? Do they look like inviting Vancouver-style thin towers?
Well, no. I mean, the renderings showing what these buildings might look like built out, if everything went to the maximum, would be, I think, in 2025. And it's, you know, like this wall of blocks, you know, that block the view of the lake or a view of anything you can see, unless you're in one of those towers, when you'd have a great view of Gasworks Park.
Well, what happened to the idea of the thin towers a la Vancouver, BC? Do you know?
Well, I don't know how this got decided, but Skip is right about the block element of it. So they're going to be sitting, and this is what has Peter Steinbrück, former city council member, so upset, is that they're going to be sitting on these kind of bread boxes, and then there are towers that come out of them. I think the idea, the problem with planning here as opposed to Vancouver is we just can't agree to have tall enough buildings where you could get the kind of density that you get with these podiums.
So 24 stories isn't high enough to do a thin tower?
I think that's one problem. And the other problem is we can't do city planning the way they can do in Vancouver because of our property rights laws. And what Peter would argue and has argued in the past is that without the ability to make sure the public benefit follows with daycare centers and playgrounds and various other things, it's very difficult to get the kind of trade-off. Because basically what you're saying with these projects is we really wouldn't let anybody build this stuff, but we're going to make an exception in
your
case.
Well, in exchange for the
exactly. We're making an exception because you're going to give us something back that's worth having. And the question is, one...
as opposed to having a philosophy.
So even if you don't agree, even if you think that that's okay, that kind of horse trading is okay, then you have to say, well, is the benefit that we get for letting you do these big ugly things, you know, is that enough? And I think one of the things Peter's arguing also is that the potential benefits to the city are not the kind that are really going to make the neighborhood better. And the tower design also isn't conducive to that.
But am I the only one that's noticed that every time there's a news story, there's Peter Steinbrück?
Well, he's working on this, right?
Yeah, I understand. He's a potential mayoral candidate is all I'm saying.
But his, you know, his client, the Mirabella, it's funny because, I mean, and he has other, you know, clients that he says he's working for pro bono in the neighborhood too. But his client is this retirement community that's mad because their views are going to be blocked. Well, they're 12 stories high. They're the tallest building in the area. So it's just, it's kind of ironic that they're complaining about this.
Aren't they blocking views of the people Capitol Hill?
Yeah, they're blocking views.
Because that was the complaint that was made when they were built.
Right. But just the difference with this Vulcan compromise that is kind of interesting and was clever on Vulcan's part is that they're actually proposing to give the city some land right there and let them start right away building. And, you know, and putting in, you know, affordable housing and putting in childcare and putting in all these goodies that, you know, that people want. And it's actually going to be in the neighborhood as opposed to with other incentive zoning programs where you can put it elsewhere or you can put it off for years. And in exchange, they're basically getting the Marshall Foster, head of planning, called it a Starbucks card. So they're getting $16 million worth of incentives that they can spend on anything they own in the neighborhood. So incentives meaning they can build taller than would ordinarily be allowed.
You know, I was over in downtown Bellevue recently walking around just looking at some of the new development over there. And, you know, Bellevue's become a big city and it's done a lot of things right. But as I was walking around, I was thinking, you know, this is really like what South Lake Union is going to be like when it's built out. It's a very still very sterile environment. It's not. And I did a neighborhood panel for City Club last week, and we had a bunch of, you know, neighborhood activists of various kinds, and the subject of South Lake Union came up, and Susie Burke, the always quotable community and businesswoman from Fremont, said, South Lake Union was beyond soulless. And she said, I love it because it makes Fremont look so good.
she's the Fremont advocate.
She is, but she's saying, you know, they have high-tech companies there and stuff, but they also have incredible neighborhood character that they have not destroyed. That's an example of...
Somewhat.
Well, it depends. Yeah. If you were like the biker bar Fremont, you're probably not happy with it now.
But what was the character of South Lake Union?
Well, no, that's the interesting thing is that South Lake Union has actually, when you walk around, it actually has a lot of great architecture in it, but it from a lot of different eras, but it's scattered. You know,
Well, you remember the argument over the commons. I mean, it was the warehouses versus this guy, this Paul Allen guy, who wanted to build it up,
right,
and see it become more urbanized.
But the question is, if you have a neighborhood, you want it to be successful, what are the strategies, you know, that you can employ that would make it a soulful, sort of interesting place? And I think that's one of the part of Peter's critique. And certainly the Amazon Plaza is not a solution.
But you can't legislate soulfulness. You know, you can't legislate aesthetics.
You can't.
At least not in Seattle.
Not in Seattle.
Nope.
Well, just a point of focus or maybe context. When you're in Bellevue, those towers are a lot taller, aren't they, than they're going to allow in South Lake Union?
Yes, they are. They are. What I was really referring to there is both the newness and the kind of just lack of a lot of the restaurants are sort of high end chain restaurants. I mean, it just doesn't feel like anybody really lives there except,
you know,
about downtown.
Yeah, when I go to Bellevue, it doesn't feel quite like that at all. You know, if you are places by the transit mall where people are actually walking, and I've noticed a number of restaurants have sort of sprouted up in that area as well. It's a different character than sort of the 1940s or 50s character that we see in the pictures and we have in our head as to what a city or a business district is supposed to look like. But it does have a character all its own.
But it is similar to what South Lake Union is constructing in its newness.
Well, it's going to be new, but I'm not so sure it's that closely similar. You know, and South Lake Union has its own challenge.
Well,
you've got a park and you got a lake. So, you know, you're not. It seems to me you're not going to build up the Fremont Business District around South Lake Union. It's going to be something else, and it's going to be very new.
I think it's partly about the light. It depends on how you build. If you take the whole block, it depends if you have building after building and you get canyons. I mean, that really seems to be an important part of this discussion. How much light can come in if you have too many tall buildings right next to each other?
I don't know. Downtown seems pretty successful, and they've got really tall buildings.
Yeah.
But that was all part of the debate, right?
In certain
right?
places, yeah. In certain very places they have more canyons. So.
Yeah. All right. What's Tim Burgess going to announce after Thanksgiving? It says a big announcement after Thanksgiving from City Councilmember Tim Burgess, right on public call.
Yeah, he's calling around to his supporters and his campaign is anyway, and making sure, you know, do we have your contact information correct? And, you know, just be around after Thanksgiving. So, if he does announce for mayor, it'll be very early.
That is early.
It's extremely early. Most of the time people announce for mayor, you know, in April or May of the year of the election.
And we may see Ed Murray announce that. Both of them had mentioned, you know, not answering that kind of a way of answering, that they were looking at right after the election and after Thanksgiving.
Well, Ed Murray has a problem that he can't raise money during the legislative session.
But you can have your name out there.
Sure.
Sally Clark, is she still a contender?
I don't think so.
No.
I think Sally is a very get-along kind of person, and she's not going to run against one of her colleagues. Now, Bruce Harrell, on the other hand, on city council, I think is going to run. He hasn't said anything conclusive.
And Peter Steinbrück, still you see his name out there.
Yeah, well, there's even a Facebook page that says, tell Peter to run or something.
So
well,
how vulnerable really is Mayor McGinn?
Extremely.
You think extremely?
I think extremely. He's raised hardly any money. He's had to cancel several fundraisers because of lack of attendance. And, I think it's possible that he could be out in the primary.
Really? What do you think?
I think it depends on who's in the primary, whether he could be not make it through the primary. It depends is Ron Sims going to get in here? He's a big vote getter. It depends on who all's in the primary.
Not in the governor's
election. And remember, you're dividing 100%. And if you put a lot of people in there, you know, 5, 6, 7 candidates, you know, there's already a businessman who's announced who has money but not name familiarity, Charles Stedeker. If you have a lot of people in there, you're dividing 100 in an unpredictable way.
Yeah, Greg Nichols knows that.
Yes, he could tell you how that works.
So no women? No women at this point?
No women.
No women.
How vulnerable do you think the mayor
should
is?
Should I run?
Yes. You and Joni Bo should run. How vulnerable do you think the mayor McGinn is?
I think he's pretty vulnerable. I mean, one of the things that's been interesting is how hard he has worked at being a regular mayor lately.
Lately.
With the press releases and appearing everywhere and doing all the, you know, doing all the kinds of things a mayor is supposed to do. But, you know, you don't see people talking about him differently, or you don't get a sense that his popularity. And you continue to have those kinds of issues that reinforce the image of a guy who, like over the DOJ deal, or, somebody who has this sort of stubborn streak that I think will make it easy for a number of candidates to play off against that.
You asked the question. Essex Porter, what do you think?
I asked the question because I don't know the answer. But one thing, Mayor McGinn is very highly visible on the new sports arena. And if that project continues to be successful and you have a spread out primary, it doesn't take very many people who are grateful to him for the sports arena to get him through the primary, if you have, especially have a widely divided field.
I will say the other thing I'll say for McGinn is no one really took him seriously when he first announced for mayor, and I'm not sure whether he has that constituency is still intact, but I wouldn't underestimate him.
I'll tell you what I'm hearing around town, and this is actually from business folks, is that McGinn has settled down. He's sort of calmed down from all this sort of noisy dust stormy stuff that he did at the beginning, that he's sort of more mayoral. That's what I've heard.
But what's funny, we called him our sore loser, our sore winner, because he actually during the budget made this huge stink about $2 million for East Lake Light Rail being pushed 1 year forward. And, you know, and a huge stink about gunshot locators, and a huge stink about, you know, all these kind of relatively tiny parts of his budget. And he basically got his budget passed, you know, virtually intact.
Yeah. As they all do. It's usually about a 5% change off of city council.
All right. Well, you can read Joni Balter on the politics blog at Seattle Times. You can see Essex Porter on Channel 7. You can read Eric C. Barnett at Publicola/Seattle Met. You could read Knut Berger at crosscut.com. We will not be here next week because we will be enjoying the holiday. You guys all enjoy the holiday. You folks enjoy the holiday. Have a good weekend. Thank you all.
Thanks. Thank you.
Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Good morning, it's 10:59. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from Best of the Northwest Art and Fine Craft Show, this weekend at Seattle's Smith Cove Cruise Terminal on Pier 91, featuring 250 Northwest artists selling handcrafted jewelry, fashions, paintings, glass art, and more. Live music and wine tastings now through Sunday. Information at nwartalliance.com.
You are to us the God, and you have saved our lives. They said, no, from now on we're going to carry you everywhere, and we're going to bring you your things. Did you, was it Johnny Walker Black? Yes, I said. Have you not? So that I said, okay, all right.
Join us for this story and more next time on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
And that comes your way Sunday at noon.
Support for KUOW comes from...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.